We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. At one time, amphetamine was considered to be a wonder drug. It was recommended in the treatment of many medical conditions, and it was considered to be safe and non-addicting. Today, however, in some parts of the world at least, methamphetamine is the leading drug problem. Some people have even used the term epidemic to describe the scope of the problem. What do we know about the effect of methamphetamine on the minds of users? What are the implications of meth production, and what has it meant for rural communities? This morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to explore these and other questions as we talk with Ralph Weisheit. He is Distinguished Professor of Criminal Justice at Illinois State University, where he's been since the summer of 1982. He has, in his academic writing, focused on a number of things, including the connections between drugs and crime, women and crime, and also the effectiveness of alcohol and drug education programs. His books include a recent book that deals with the subject that we're talking about here, a book that he co-authored titled Methamphetamine, Its History, Pharmacology, and Treatment. He's also written on crime and policing in rural and small-town America. He's written about juvenile delinquency, and also he's written about the commercial domestic marijuana industry, among other things. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome from listeners. We only ask people to be brief so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible and keep moving along. Certainly, your input is welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point, questions and comments are welcome. Well, Professor Weisheit, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us again. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time. You know, I suspect that with as much coverage as the meth problem has gotten in media, I guess there might be some people who aren't exactly sure what it is that we are talking about. Do you want to just, as a way for those people who are not schooled in illicit drugs, just talk a little bit about what methamphetamine is?
Sure. Methamphetamine is a drug that is part of a family of drugs that we call stimulants. These would include amphetamines, cocaine, things like Ritalin, ecstasy, for example. It distinguishes itself from other members of this family primarily in its potency. It is substantially stronger than typical amphetamines such as dexedrine, for example. But beyond that, the effects are really quite similar.
And this is, I guess, there that points to why it is that it can and has become a serious problem. And of course, these other things, prescription versions of some of these drugs can indeed be addictive. But the potential for a person to become addicted with methamphetamine is, it sounds like it's even higher than with some of those other things.
I think that's probably true because of its potency. Mm. You know, one of the things about methamphetamine, there are so many myths and misunderstandings about it, as happens any time a drug comes onto the scene as a new issue or new problem. But one of the myths is that it's instantly addictive, that people cannot use it at all without losing control of it. But the reality is, and most people are completely unaware of this, meth can be legally prescribed by a doctor, and it is given, in fact, in some cases, even to small children.
I suppose that does go to the point that I made, and I think that it is still the case that drugs like this are available as prescription medicines and are sometimes given, and that there are reasons for giving them. So we wouldn't want to say that there would be no legitimate reason for someone to take it, particularly if they were taking it under the direction of a doctor.
And it's also true that it's a curious drug in that in low doses under a doctor's supervision, and notice I was careful to put those two things together, it appears to do relatively little harm to the user or to the user's body or mind. But in high doses, without some kind of monitoring by a doctor, it can be incredibly destructive.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the fact that perhaps there are a number of myths or things about meth that people misunderstand or don't understand. And one of the things that you mentioned was the fact that some people think that it is instantly and immediately addictive, and from the first time someone used it, they would fall off the cliff like that. What are some of the other things you think that people think they know about meth that aren't true?
Well, one common belief is that there is no effective treatment for methamphetamine abuse. It's true that it's difficult to stop using, but it's difficult to stop for many smokers to stop using cigarettes. It's difficult for alcoholics to stop using alcohol. And the initial reports, even from professionals, was that meth is a drug from which people just don't successfully withdraw. But that appears, as time has passed, that that's just not true, that the success rate for methamphetamine treatment is similar to that for cocaine, and it's not terribly different from that for the alcoholic. What it means is that someone who is addicted will have a tough go of it. They will probably try to stop a number of times before they're successful, but they can eventually stop.
There certainly are a number of drugs that are illegal that cause social problems. I guess there's also one big one that's legal that does also cause social problems, that I'm thinking about alcohol, but that's sort of another issue. That there are a number of things that cause problems. Is there something about methamphetamine that is different, or is it just that for some number of reasons, and we can talk about them, that it's really captured our attention?
Well, it's different in a couple of ways. It's different in the immediate effects. You know, most people don't like alcohol the first time they try it. They don't like cigarettes the first time they try them. And it turns out that that's true for most illegal drugs. Most people who try heroin don't like it the first time they try it. But in the case of methamphetamine, almost everyone who tries it immediately finds it pleasurable. Hmm. It may not be instantly addictive, but it is instantly pleasurable. It feels really good from the very first time. So that's one thing that makes it different from other drugs. You don't have to learn to like it. The other thing that makes it different is this whole issue of methamphetamine production. So that in addition to problems from the drug itself, you now have issues that come about from toxic chemicals used in the production process, and to what extent do they contaminate the buildings in which the manufacturing is done, to what extent do they contaminate the environment, to what extent does the cooking of meth endanger children and others in the immediate environment while cooking is going on. All those are things in production that we just don't see with cocaine or heroin, which tend to be produced elsewhere and then brought here.
Mm. So I guess that's an interesting dimension here, is that we have not only do we have issues with distribution and use, but that it is domestically, can be locally or regionally produced in a way that some of the things not. So then we get another layer of problems that come with that.
Absolutely. And here in the Midwest, if you look at central Illinois, the overwhelming majority of the methamphetamine that is used is methamphetamine that's produced here, which is different from California and Arizona, New Mexico, where much of the meth is actually made in Mexico and brought in.
Hmm. This is something that if you ask this question, where is it the greatest problem? Indeed, this does seem to be something that's has a kind of a regional nature. That is, it is a big problem, but it's not a big problem everywhere. Where are the levels of methamphetamine use the greatest?
Well, the highest levels of use are actually in the West. And if you look at subgroups or population groups, we always think of meth as this white man's drug, this kind of white trash drug is the image that the media has portrayed. But actually the group with the highest rate of problems related to meth are Native Americans.
Really? Why is how can you explain that this kind of regional thing that say the West, it's the biggest in the United States, the place where it's the biggest problem is in the Western United States?
Well, the only explanation we have, and of course we're always guessing when we do these kinds of things, the only explanation is that it really started in the West. It started in really San Diego for many, many years has been sort of the capital. If you go back to the early 1980s, long before it was even seen here in the Midwest, it was a huge issue in San Diego. And some believe that it came from San Diego via Hawaii. And again, from Hawaii, it went from Hawaii to San Diego, but it got to Hawaii through Asia. And Asia, of course, remains today still the primary place in the world where methamphetamine is used.
The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ralph Weisheit. He is a professor of criminal justice at Illinois State University. He's done a lot of writing on the subject of the connection between crimes and drugs. He's also written about the effectiveness of alcohol and drug education programs and methamphetamine, just one of the things that he has written on. He's the co-author of a recently published book titled Methamphetamine, Its History, Pharmacology, and Treatment. He's also now working on a book on meth in America. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. These drugs that we're talking about, sort of this large class of drugs, actually has a fairly long history, maybe not as long as some others, but a fairly long history. I think it is the case that amphetamine was first synthesized in a laboratory in the late 19th century?
Yes, the late 1800s, absolutely, by a Japanese scientist.
So it's been around for a while. What was it that they were interested in that led to this this development?
Well, again, if you look historically, this is a curious time, because this was a time when they were constantly trying to find new drugs that they could patent and therefore make lots of money off of. There were relatively few restrictions on drugs. And curiously enough, when researchers were doing research on the effects of these drugs, the research subject was often the researcher himself.
Hmm.
But it was always a matter of trying to find miracle cures. Really, if you look at the late 1800s, that was really the beginning of what we would think of as modern medicine, of a time when people started applying scientific principles to the study of illness and human maladies.
And what's interesting about this is it seems to be the kind of thing that indeed began with people thinking that it would have a lot of positive applications and that it wouldn't have a lot of problems associated with it.
Absolutely. In fact, it's interesting because methamphetamine really is around since 1919, and as recently as the early 1960s, medical professionals thought it was a relatively harmless drug. In fact, in the 1960s in California, they were actually administering methamphetamine as a treatment for heroin addiction.
So what happened? Is it that it made the jump from that to something that a lot of people were actually making in basement and backyard and wherever laboratories? It was the fact that it was something that actually people could make, provided they had the access to the raw materials?
Well, until the 1960s, they could buy it legally under a name Methadrin, and it was legally available in an injectable form, and people didn't need to make it. They could get it through their doctors, who, again, were pretty generous about prescribing it. In the 1960s in California, they started cracking down and restricting the availability of this injectable form, and that's when you started seeing the first methamphetamine labs in the San Francisco area in around 1962, somewhere in there. And it appears to have been started by some soldiers returning from Korea and the Asian Rim who had been exposed to methods of cooking there and brought that knowledge back with them.
Hmm. So in looking at that, looking at how it sort of made these jumps, is there something there that is interesting or that's useful to learn that can be applied to the way we think about other kinds of drug problems?
Well, one of the things you see is a pattern over and over of a drug being used as a recognized medical treatment and as being seen as relatively harmless or of minor harm as something that can be used to treat other drug-related problems. And it's seen that way, and then over time, as more and more people use it, the downside, the negatives start surfacing, and it comes to be demonized. You see this over and over.
Is that, it seems like that's curious, because if drugs like these do have good medical uses, and they're the kind of things that can, if you keep them well controlled and closely, the people who use them are closely monitored and the access to the drug are controlled, that if they've got some sort of positive benefit, how is it that it manages, they get away from us in a sense? Is that something that's just sort of inevitable, do you think?
Probably. I mean, we're seeing it now with prescription narcotics, that here you have really useful drugs that have clear medical value, but you're seeing a real wave of misuse of these prescription drugs. And by the way, some people, my co-author in the book, for example, has suggested that historically, if you look at these cycles, that periods of stimulant use get followed by periods of narcotics use. Because narcotics are one way to come down from being up too long under these stimulants.
One of the basic questions that you pose in the book is, when you take a look at the problem that we have now, is you asking this question, well, what's the extent of the problem? What's the right way to talk about it? And whether, in fact, if you, as I mentioned, if you use a term like epidemic to apply to patterns of meth use, particularly in some places, whether that's the right word to use.
It's people have been debating this recently, and my response is that it is probably not accurate to describe it as a national epidemic, but it certainly has regions of the country, sections of the country, where epidemic would be the right term. There's no reason why you can't talk about a localized epidemic, just as we might with the flu, for example. And I think that's true in the case of methamphetamine.
Perhaps you can talk a little bit more about treatment. And you mentioned that one of the misunderstandings perhaps that people have, they have the idea that there isn't any treatment, or there's no effective treatment, when in fact that there is. That's not to say it would be easy, but that it actually is possible. Is this treatment much like it would be for people who are abusing other kinds of things, or is there something particularly special about this?
Well, it's certainly similar to treatment for cocaine abuse, and cocaine's another stimulant. It is a little different from, say, heroin treatment. You know, with heroin, you have physical withdrawal. You have flu-like symptoms that go along with withdrawal. In the case of these stimulants, including methamphetamine, the withdrawal is much more psychological, much more emotional than physical. So that if, for example, a woman is a heroin addict and is pregnant, they will probably put her on something like methadone for the course of her pregnancy, because the trauma of withdrawal would be difficult for the fetus. But in the case of these stimulants, they wouldn't do that, because it's not physically traumatic. It's psychologically difficult, because meth is probably a little tougher than cocaine. You're going to have more relapses and failures. Eventually you can lick it, but you're going to have more relapses along the way, because it is more potent. And one of the consequences of use is that you feel really, really good. You feel you can do anything, that you're all powerful. But when the effects wear off, you are correspondingly depressed. You are correspondingly feeling blue and negative. And even when that initial depression wears off, there is this sense, it's called anhedonia, this feeling that the world is no longer out there in bright colors. It's no longer a beautiful sunny day, but everything is just blah. Everything is gray and bland. And the user knows that one way to bring that bright color back into the world would be to use meth again. And so the real emphasis now for many of the treatment programs is on teaching the person to look for those cues that would trigger cravings, and teaching them to basically not let those triggers lead them back into use. And the triggers can be something as simple as driving by a house where you once used the drug can now induce this uncontrollable, in your mind, uncontrollable urge to use again. And so the treatment is often a matter of training them to know what those triggers will be and to figure out ways of responding that do not involve use.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller is in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. In your discussion so far, you've talked a lot about the various problems with drugs, illegal drugs of all sorts, and it seems you've missed one aspect. At least I have missed a little bit. You seem to have missed one of the most important aspects of the drug problem in our failed drug policy, in that you don't address money. Profit is the thing that drives every bit of our drug problems. If we would solve that aspect of it, we would improve all of these problems a great deal.
You're half right. It turns out that in the case of methamphetamine, there are really two structures for making and distributing the drugs. There are these large organizations right at the moment primarily driven by people either in Mexico or who are from Mexico doing their production here. And those individuals are driven by money. It's a money business. Their purpose is to make profits, and the profits are enormous. However, there's another cluster of users, and I would again argue here in the Midwest, you see this in Illinois, central Illinois in particular, there's very little money trading hands in the case of methamphetamine. This home-cooked meth is not driven primarily by money. What you're finding is that someone will learn how to cook, and they will turn to some of their friends who want the drug, and they will say, you go over and get this ingredient that I need. And this other person, you go get this other ingredient. And this other person will get this other ingredient. And if you all bring me these things, I will make a batch of meth and we'll split it up. And if you're really bringing me a lot of stuff, I'll even teach you how to make the drug. And so when you talk to meth task force officers in Illinois, for example, they'll say that, they've said to me, look, when I take down a cocaine operation or even a large marijuana operation, there's usually cash. There's sometimes property I can take. But in the case of meth, there's just nothing to take because there's not much money floating around with this. It's a barter system.
But what I'm getting at, sir, is all of the drug problems we have today are really tied back to money. Even meth in the fact that you get involved with other drugs, you see these other drugs, you start experimenting with more and more drugs. It's always, if we can keep all the drugs in a pharmaceutical situation and get rid of the dealers and prosecute the dealers, but allow the users to find a possible outlet, that then will reduce the money to all these people and reduce all the drugs overall.
Two responses to that. One is that this idea of it being available, of making it more prescription-oriented and under the supervision of a doctor, we currently do have a huge problem with prescription narcotics being abused, and those fit exactly under that kind of model. I would agree, however, that you're right when you talk about being exposed to other drugs. One of the problems of figuring out the full effects of methamphetamine is that most methamphetamine users use a variety of drugs, and meth isn't their only drug. And you talk about the effects of methamphetamine on the developing fetus. Well, the overwhelming majority of women who are meth users and pregnant also smoke tobacco during their pregnancy. Many of them will use alcohol. And these are two drugs that we know affect the fetus, and so it becomes difficult to disentangle meth from other things. So it's certainly true that meth users are exposed to and may use other drugs, but it's also true that this prescription system hasn't stopped narcotic drugs from becoming a major problem through the prescription system.
I agree also with that, sir, very, very, very firmly, but we have to step away from this model that we have now that is truly a failed system of trying to control this. Thank you very much.
All right. We're at our midpoint here. Questions are welcome. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus 580 with Ralph Weisheit. He's Distinguished Professor of Criminal Justice at Illinois State University, where he's been since the summer of 1982. In his writing, he's worked on a number of things, looking at the connection between drugs and crime, women and crime, and also the effectiveness of alcohol and drug education programs. He's now working on a book on meth in America. His books include one that he co-authored that's just recently out that's titled Methamphetamine, Its History, Pharmacology, and Treatment. He's also written on crime and policing in rural and small-town America. He's written on juvenile justice and juvenile delinquency. He's also written on the domestic marijuana industry. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess that you know, the question that the caller raised, and probably every time here on this program that we've talked about the issue of illegal drugs and what it is we need to do about that, there will be person or persons who say, well, the problem here is the law enforcement approach that we're taking, and that we would actually do better if these things were decriminalized, maybe even legalized, and we have some sort of institutional kind of system to make them available to people, that we take organized crime out of the picture, and at least we wouldn't have all the kinds of violence associated with the fact that it's illegal. And it sounds as if that for you and for people who work in the, you know, academic criminal justice field, that sounds like you would say, well, that maybe sounds like a good idea, but probably wouldn't work as well as people would think.
Well, I would agree with the caller and with many, many people who believe our current system is just not doing much to really address the problem. It's clearly not the answer. That doesn't mean that we know what the answer is. One of the things that will keep me busy in my career for a long time is we don't really have a solution. As frustrating as that may be to say, you know, I would point out something interesting. During the 1980s and early 90s, if you look through Europe, there was a dramatic increase in the use of cocaine. And what's interesting about that increase is you saw that increase regardless of the kind of official response that a country had, whether it was a liberal, lax country like the Netherlands, whether it was a stricter country like Germany, for example. It didn't seem to matter what the particular legal response was. Use went up rather dramatically. Hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that restrictions are irrelevant. I mean, but it's a complicated issue, and I'm always reluctant to give a simple answer to something that, in my mind, is an issue that the more I think about it, the messier it gets.
Hmm. Well, let's go on talk with some other folks. We'll go to Champaign next, line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question and a comment. A couple of years ago, my husband and I heard a drug enforcement agency officer, newly retired, speak in southern Arizona. And you can imagine that southern Arizona is a pretty popular place for meth labs. He spoke about, and he showed us pictures of people who had been meth users. The teeth were loose or missing. The skin would make an acne-infested teenager feel like he had gorgeous skin. It was just dreadful. And would you mind talking about that a little bit? Because I think maybe if people knew that before they start taking this stuff, maybe they would slow down. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you can talk about, you know, we've talked a little earlier about what happened, about addiction and about what this does psychologically. It also, long-term use of the drug also has real significant physiological effects.
Absolutely. And I do want to clear up one myth, and that is that there's, I think, a public perception that if you use meth, you automatically lose your teeth and have this horror and start picking at your skin until you're covered with sores. And if you don't use meth, that doesn't happen. The reality is that even for meth users, there are a range of responses, and there are recreational meth users who never develop those issues. But there are those who use at extreme levels that it's pretty horrific what happens to them. The damage to the teeth is an interesting one. There was a myth floating around that this was because of the harsh chemicals used to make the drug. That does not appear to be true. It appears more likely that what's going on is that meth is what is called a vasoconstrictor. It restricts the blood vessels, which limits then the amount of blood flowing through an area, including the mouth, and it dries out the mouth. You get less saliva. And when your saliva level goes down, the acidity of the saliva actually goes up, which is more damaging to the teeth. But also, as your mouth dries out, that turns out to be a prime area for bacteria to grow. A dry mouth is one in which bacteria is more likely to be cultivated. And then on top of that, because it's a constrictor and you get dry mouth, meth users tend to consume enormous amounts of sugary soft drinks, which then contributes to the problem. And then on top of that, meth appears to lead people to grind their teeth, and this grinding is something that they do unconsciously. In fact, it goes on for as long as 30 days after they stop using, and it grinds off the layers of the teeth that protect that inner area where the nerve cells are. And then on top of all that, meth users who are the heavy extreme users tend to be pretty lousy about personal hygiene. And, of course, once your teeth start going bad, you now have a disincentive to brush and take more care of them because it hurts to brush. So that's one of the things. And the picking is part of what the skin picking is part of, again, extreme use, where people believe that it's called meth bugs. Their skin itches and they feel like there are bugs right under the skin and they pick at it. But it's also part of an automatic kind of behavior referred to by psychologists as stereotyped behavior, which is repetitive behavior that can take many forms. In fact, in addition to this picking of skin, for males it often takes the form of disassembling things like electronics. They'll take a television set or a stereo apart down to its tiniest components without having a clue as to how to put them back together again. Or they'll disassemble an automobile. And there are other things that go along with this. And again, at the extreme levels, you're talking about the rise of psychosis, which involves paranoia, where you think people are out to get you. And so it's not unusual to have meth users with weapons because they want to protect themselves from these imagined invaders who are coming after them. You also have curious psychological phenomena. One of them is this idea that everything around you is related to you, so that if you're watching a TV news program, you believe that national news anchor is talking about you personally. You believe that two people across the street talking to each other are talking about you. It's called idea of reference, this notion of everything is focused on you. And there are a host of other, there are a host of other just quirky, odd psychological conditions that can really be a problem. Now, most of those go away when you stop using, except for people who already have some serious mental health problems, in which case that psychosis and those symptoms can go on for a long time after use stops.
All right. I appreciate the question. Let's go on and talk with someone else. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yes. My only experience with meth users comes through a friend of mine who's a judge, a trial judge in Arkansas, and his profile of the people who come before him, I guess, is a myth because he identifies them to me as low-income, rural, Caucasian Americans. And I think I heard you say we have that, we call that, what, white trash, even though I don't like that term. Now, but then you disabuse me of that notion when you said that the predominant ethnic or racial group that meth users or Native Americans. Did I understand you to say that?
You understood that correctly, but we're talking about percent of a population group. Now, Native Americans are a small percent of the U.S. population, so
right. They
have, in terms of raw numbers, you're probably talking about white and often males, although females are more represented with meth than most other drugs. But this idea that, by the way, it's a white rural phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
is generally true in the Midwest, with a big note of caution here. If you talk to a cop in Chicago, they'll tell you, we don't really have meth here. But the reality is there's quite a bit of meth in Chicago. But in Chicago, New York, Miami, many of these major cities, they have a substantial amount of meth in the gay community as a party drug, as a club drug. And the reason why a cop in Chicago will tell you we don't have much meth here is that, your typical gay party goer is not doing robberies to get the drug. They're employed. They're buying it through personal connections rather than on the street. They're not manufacturing, so you don't find the labs. It's imported for them, typically in rather pure pill form. So it's there, but it's not very visible. But the visible pattern of use is certainly in the Midwest. If you look at Illinois, it's rural and predominantly white. But, of course, in not so much Arkansas, but Illinois, if you're going into rural areas, the number of minorities is rather small by comparison to the number of whites.
What can you account in terms of environmental or whatever else for the disproportionate use of it within the Native American community?
You know, that's a great question. I don't have an answer for that. I don't even know someone who's speculated on why that would be true. I know that the manufacturing on reservations is an enormous issue. But, you know, the reality is Native Americans as a group have enormous substance abuse problems, period. Alcohol, cocaine, other drugs are just a huge issue. So why this particular one has become popular there, I sometimes say trying to predict these trends is like predicting fashion.
Mm-hmm.
We can look back later and make up explanations, but we don't really know for sure.
All right. Thank you, Professor.
Right, thank you. On to Hidalgo. This is another caller here, line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah.
I was wondering how a guy is with I've prescribed for fentanyl, F-E-N-T-A-N-Y-L, transdermic system for my pain. Is that a drug that's habit-forming, or what is it?
It can be. It is part of this family of narcotics. It's, in fact, it's the drug that made some really big headlines in the last year in the Chicago area because people were selling it as a substitute for heroin. Now, again, all of these kinds of painkillers have the potential to become addictive, but that doesn't mean they will be. It means that you pay attention to your doctor and not take more than the doctor says. And what you find, you know, we commonly give people morphine who have back surgery, and it's rare for anyone, almost unheard of, for someone to become a morphine addict as a result of back surgery. It's when people go beyond what their doctor recommends. If you look at people who do doctor shopping, so they get a prescription from more than one doctor, for example, that's a problem. But if you've got a responsible doctor and they're keeping a limit on how much you're taking, you should be fine.
Well, cause of my pain is back pain. I've had it ever since. I had it for about 8 years now, and they got me on this fentanyl or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And without it, I couldn't hardly take it. You know, before I got started, I was done.
Yep.
I'm 80 years old.
Well, again, the key is not that the drug itself is a problem. It's when people go beyond what their doctor is recommending, when they start taking more than they absolutely need to have, that's when it becomes a problem.
Is a dose of 75. I was taking 50 mg, and now I'm on 75.
Well, I'm not a doctor, so I would be reluctant to say what dose is right for you. But again, if you've got a responsible doctor, I would... You have to trust somebody, and I would trust them, I think.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've got to do something, or I can't live with my pain. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
you know,
people worry about being addicted, but the truth is you don't want to live in pain. And in some ways in our society, we've been too cautious, and we've allowed people to suffer more than they really need to. And back pain is a good example where it makes sense to take painkillers.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Ralph Weisheit. He's Distinguished Professor of Criminal Justice at Illinois State University. And in his writing, he looks at things like connections between drugs and crime, also the effectiveness of alcohol and drug education programs. We're talking about methamphetamine, something that he's written about. He's now working on a book on methamphetamine in America, and also now is the co-author of one that's out. The title of that book is Methamphetamine, Its History, Pharmacology, and Treatment. Other questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I was just thinking about the earlier caller who was talking about the fact that maybe if people were more aware of all of the various negative effects of meth usage, that they might not try it. They might not get involved in it. And I guess I found myself thinking about, and this is maybe a little bit different, but thinking back, for example, to the time when I was in high school in driver's education, and they were trying to convince us that we should be safe drivers. And so what did they do? Well, they showed us these movies of really horrible car accidents. Mm-hmm. And similarly in health class, when they didn't want you to smoke, what did they do? Well, they showed you diseased lungs. Stuff like that. And now we have public service campaigns that are directed to people trying to steer them away from these drugs and say, don't get involved. And we show them these horrible scenarios and we say, see, if you get involved with meth, this is the way that you're going to turn out. But it seems to be the case that that sort of approach, whether we're talking about wanting people to be safe drivers or not smoke or not use drugs, it seems that for most people, that just doesn't work. I'm not sure why it doesn't work, but it seems that it's actually not very effective.
That's generally true, and well, part of it is let's go back to the horrific images you see in driver's ed. Mm-hmm. I always worry most about kids who want to see them again and again. Those are kids who worry me the most. And they've done large-scale studies of that kind of thing with driver's ed, and what they find is there's just no real difference. It doesn't have an impact. And part of the problem is, even like the lungs that you see from smokers, for many people, and particularly for young people, there's this sense of, well, that's not going to happen to me. I have an uncle who smoked all his life, and he lived to be 95. Or this sense of you're just not vulnerable, that you know, and... You also have to be really careful. I remember during the 60s there was a campaign against heroin that actually backfired. It actually had addicts seeking out more heroin, addicts of other drugs, switching to heroin because the ad campaign said, it's so good, don't even try it once. And people saying, if it's that good, let me add it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. We don't have much. I do think these kind of campaigns, there are all these ads on TV now about the dangers of meth. I think they probably do more to make parents feel good than they do to actually stop use. And I should point out, too, by the way, that among drugs, meth is not typically a drug that kids start with. They typically start with things like inhalants, and meth comes along later. The typical meth user is someone who starts when they're in their early to mid-20s or even a little bit later. And there are kids who start, but when kids start, that's often a kid who's got real problems.
One of the approaches I think that has been taken to try to minimize meth production is to do what can be done to control the raw materials so that mm-hmm. it makes it more difficult for people to get, or at least get significant amounts of the raw materials that you need. Mm-hmm. How effective can that be in trying to limit people's ability to produce meth?
Well, there's no question that if you make it harder to get the raw materials, it's going to make it harder to produce. But we've had a curious phenomena. A number of states, including Illinois, had put in restrictions. The federal government put in restrictions in 2006. And what you saw was an immediate plummeting in the number of meth labs that were found. But now we're seeing a rebound. We're seeing that there are states that have had as many labs in the first half of 2009 as they had for all of 2008. And 2008 had more labs than they had in 2007. So we're seeing a bounce back, and part of it is something that they've learned to do a better job of what's called smurfing. I remember I said that it's common for a cook to have a network of people around him who get materials, and one of the ways to get the ephedrine that is needed, and ephedrine is the key ingredient in things like Sudafed, one of the ways to get that is to have people go out and buy the limit at one pharmacy and then go to another pharmacy and buy the limit and go to another pharmacy and buy the limit. Because it turns out that while these pharmacies all have to keep a record, that the Walgreens, for example, is typically not connected to CVS. So that if you buy more than one, more than you're allowed to buy at Walgreens, they will stop you. But CVS won't know that you already made your purchase at Walgreens. And there are still a few pharmacies around that are doing all this on paper yet. And the idea of networking them all together is an issue that I think may happen at some point, but right now it's an issue of money. Who would pay for building this network that all of the different pharmacies would be connected to? And no one seems to have the money to do that at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's tough when you're talking about something that is a commonly available over-the-counter medication for people who have cold symptoms, and that it's the kind of thing that anywhere that they sell over-the-counter medications, grocery stores and pharmacies and who knows where all else, they're going to have it.
Now, some places, there is a state in the West, I think it's Oregon, if I remember correctly, and there is a community in Missouri that has moved to requiring a prescription for Sudafed and related drugs. That clearly will make some difference, but it's a burden again on the doctors and pharmacists that they're not thrilled about taking on.
All right, let's talk with someone in Sycamore on our toll-free line, our line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. This topic was touched on earlier by a caller about money. But I've heard a number of sources comment that the war on drugs is lost, and what we should do is just the federal government should spend the money it's spending on enforcement and contact the major pharmaceuticals, crank this stuff up in major production runs and make it freely available to everyone who has to have it, and thereby eliminating all the criminology associated with it. Now, I'd be interested to hear your comments on that thought, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, it certainly would not deal entirely with the crime problem. It would certainly deal with things like theft of precursors, stealing things. One of the things that's really interesting about meth is it's been around for a long time, but up until about 1960 or so, you saw very little in the literature about any connection between meth and violence. People had to actually go out and scour the records to find evidence of this. There just wasn't much going on. And even today, I would argue a couple things. That one, that there's not a strong link between meth and violence, except for people who already have violent tendencies. Meth will magnify those. But you're not going to take someone who's is peaceful and mellow and quiet and turn them into a violent maniac. But someone who's violent is going to likely to become more so. But beyond that, One of the areas that there does appear to be something going on is that there does appear to be a link between methamphetamine use and domestic violence. And part of the reason is that when people come down from meth, they tend to be really irritable. And it's long-lasting, so they may get their drug from their buddy and take it, but it's not until after they're home that the effects start wearing off. They're very irritable, and domestic violence, I wouldn't say it's common, but it's certainly not unheard of. And it's the most frequent kind of violence that you'll see out of methamphetamine, I think.
Hmm. We're coming down to the point that we have maybe about 2-3 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, if someone calls in with a question real quick, we can get them in. Maybe you can talk to us a little bit about, I mentioned a couple of times that you've done a lot of writing about rural and rural policing.
Mm-hmm.
Has this become a particularly significant problem for the police forces of small communities?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A survey was done of rural sheriffs and chiefs by this National Association of Counties, and methamphetamine came out as one of their number one problems. And again, you're talking about departments that are typically struggling for resources. They often, the smallest agencies may not even have officers 24/7, and it's a real challenge for them.
We want to get at least one more caller here. We have somebody in Urbana wants to make a quick comment on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Fascinating program, again. I don't know that this has been mentioned, but there is a fascinating book that I read called No Speed Limit, and it it goes through the whole history of uppers and speed in, you know, from its inception. I think it was developed by the Germans during World War II. But it was a great read. I recommend it to anyone that's listening to the show that is interested in the subject.
All right. Well, thank you.
I would also recommend it. It is a really good book. It's very, and it's accessible, written by a British journalist. So he comes at this from the point of view of an outsider looking into American culture.
What sort of, just again, real quick, maybe we have about a minute or so, what sort of challenges for rural law enforcement does the fact that if you find a meth lab, you not only, you know, you have this really serious problem with toxic waste, all the chemicals and stuff that they use to produce it. I imagine there are a lot of places that wouldn't have the resources or wouldn't exactly know how to approach dealing with something like that.
And it's not just police. It's, think about rural fire departments, these volunteer mm-hmm. departments. When there's a fire from a meth lab, they need to go in and may not know what kind of toxic things. They may not even know there was a meth lab. They just know there's a fire. But they may find needles. Meth is a drug that can be taken in injectable form. They may have their guys crawling on the floor, crawling through a bunch of needles. So even emergency responders, aside from police, may find it's a real problem. And you know, if you're a rural agency and you come across one of these labs, the first response here would be to call the state police and have their teams come in. But you also have to wonder what's going to happen when the team leaves, because it's the property owner who is financially responsible for the real cleanup. And what if the property owner just walks away? Now, who pays for cleaning up? And if nobody does, do you cordon off the property and make it inaccessible to everyone? I haven't heard good answers to those kinds of things yet. Mm-hmm.
Well, there, we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. I want to say again thanks to our guest, Ralph Weisheit. He is a distinguished professor of criminal justice at Illinois State University. He is the co-author of a book, if you're interested in reading on the subject, this book. It's entitled Methamphetamine, Its History, Pharmacology, and Treatment. He's co-authored this with William White. It's published by Hazelden. And you, Ralph, at some point in the future, you're going to have another book, you think?
It seems like there's always one in the works, yes.
All right. Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That is it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our monthly look at diet and nutrition with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. She'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 502 and a quarter, up 3 and a quarter. March, 517 and a half, up 2 and a half. December wheat in Chicago, 497 and three quarters, up 3 and a half. March, 516 and three quarters, up 2 and three quarters. December corn, 367 and three quarters, up 1 and three quarters. March, 381, up 1 and three quarters. May, 390 and a half, up 2 and a quarter. July, 398 and a half, up 2. November beans, 981 and three quarters, up 3 and three quarters. January, 981 and a half, up 5. March, 982 and a quarter, up 7 and a quarter. May, 978 and a quarter, up 8 and a quarter. July, 979 and three quarters, up 7 and a quarter. December meal, 298.10, up 110. December oil, 36.56, up 16. December live cattle, 85.50, down 17 and a half. February, 86.70, down 15. November feeder cattle, 95.10, up 30. January, 95.35, up 27 and a half. December lean hogs, 57.05.